Hi again. Welcome back to the Scandinavian History Podcast with me, Michael Schenkman. Last time, we saw how Duke Carl became the third of Gustav Vasa's sons to ascend the throne of Sweden. Carl claimed the crown after he had fought a war against his nephew, Sigismund. After losing the war against his uncle, Sigismund had to settle for only being the king of Poland. The war between the fiercely Lutheran Carl and the Catholic Sigismund didn't just cause awkwardness at Vasa family gatherings, it also fostered anti-Catholicism in Sweden. We'll see more of that in future episodes. Today, though, we'll see that Carl IX of Sweden also had Lutheran enemies. We'll also get an introduction to the longest reigning king in Danish history, the king who built the Stock Exchange in Copenhagen, the historic building that tragically burned down only a few weeks ago on April 16th, 2024. Episode 84, The Kalmar War. In 1577, King Frederick II of Denmark had a son. Well, technically, his wife, Queen Sophia of Mecklenburg, had a son. The point is that the birth of the lad was greeted with great joy and enthusiasm, because so far the royal couple had only had daughters. And in 16th century Denmark, girls couldn't expect to become monarchs. So the birth of a son was great news. Not only for the king, who was already middle-aged, but also to those in his kingdom who weren't keen on a war of succession after he died. Still, since Denmark was officially an elective monarchy, the young prince, called Christian like his grandfather, wasn't elected heir to the throne before 1580, when he was 3 years old. 8 years later, in 1588, Frederick II died, leaving the throne to the 11-year-old Christian. Of course, not even in the 16th century, when people still earnestly believed in kings by the grace of God, was anyone willing to let a prepubescent child actually govern the kingdom. So a regency government was established to run Denmark until Christian at least had passed through puberty. But in 1596, when he was 19 years old, the young king was allowed to take up the reins of his own as Christian IV. The first years of his reign were great. The economy was still booming and the kingdom's coffers were full. Thanks to the Danish control of the passage in and out of the Baltic Sea, money kept streaming into the royal treasury without the king or anyone else having to do much of anything at all, except insisting that anyone who wanted to pass through the Öresund Strait pony up. In accordance with the economic theories of the day, Christian IV also granted trade monopolies to cities in order to make them grow. That meant that people who wanted to buy or sell stuff had to go to the markets in the nearest city and pay taxes there. Christian also encouraged trade by establishing the trade companies for Iceland, Greenland, and the East Indies. All this disposable income must have burned in young Christian's pocket, because throughout his reign he initiated many construction projects, and you can't walk through central Copenhagen today without running into buildings he commissioned, such as the Round Tower, Rosenborg Castle, and the Stock Exchange, which, as I mentioned, was severely damaged by fire just a few weeks ago. So Christian IV took over a well-functioning and wealthy kingdom that had enjoyed peace and prosperity for decades. That was good, of course, but it wasn't enough for young Christian. He had been raised to believe that a real king shouldn't merely administer a well-functioning bureaucracy and keep track of a steady stream of tax revenues. Where was the glory in that? No, a real king, a great king, should not only leave splendid buildings, but also fight glorious wars. And Christian IV had a particular war in mind. He dreamed of dealing Sweden a fatal blow and ultimately forcing the renegade northern neighbors back into the Kalmar Union under Danish domination. Once Sweden had been subdued, Denmark would become the unrivaled regional superpower in northern Europe, financially, politically, and militarily. Already in 1604, King Christian brought up the idea of a glorious war against Sweden. The king needed the approval of the Council of the Realm in order to attack, and so Christian tried to convince the members of the council that a short and successful war would finish off the elderly Karl IX, and since there were no more adult males left in the Vasa family, Sweden would be plunged into chaos. Then he could swoop in and scoop up the Swedish crown. Easy peasy. But beyond the dreams of glory and a renewed Kalmar Union, there were also other, more tangible reasons for a war. Lately, Sweden had intensified its attempts to break free of the Danish stranglehold over the Baltic Sea. The Swedes had been looking to establish ports with direct access to the Atlantic Ocean that wouldn't require passing through the Øresund Strait, thus bypassing the Danish toll station in Elsinore. As king, Karl IX had continued his policy of encouraging economic activity, just like he had in his duchy when he was duke, but now on a national scale. To that end, he had founded a new port city called Gothenburg on the west coast, in the small gap between Norway and Denmark, protected by the crucial Elfsborg Castle that had been redeemed from Denmark. The English and the Dutch were now directing a considerable part of their trade with Sweden to this new port city, which meant that the revenues from the important Øresund toll had dropped for the Danes. In addition, the Swedes were also trying to expand northward toward the Arctic seacoast. In the early 17th century, there was still no clear border between Norway and Sweden in the mostly uninhabited wilderness known as Lapland, the land where the nomadic indigenous Sami people lived. Even though they couldn't claim direct control over the territory, the Norwegians had traditionally been collecting tax from the Sami. But lately, the Swedes had also started to do so. That was a provocation to the Danish crown, not only because they considered this to be their tax revenues, but also because of the implicit political claim. If you tax a people or a territory, you claim it as your own. This, and not the modest sums squeezed out of the Sami taxpayers, was the real issue. And what really worried Christian IV was that the northern sea route to Russia via the Arctic Ocean had been increasing in importance as the Dutch and the English grew increasingly tired of paying the Øresund toll. That meant that the control over the ports along the Scandinavian Arctic coastline also became more important. If you controlled the ports, you'd be able to tax cargo and sell provisions and other stuff to the ship's crews, sailing back and forth between the continent and the Russian port city of Arkhangelsk. In 1598, trying to put an end to the Swedish expansion in the Arctic, Christian IV issued a ban on the Sami to pay taxes to Sweden. Karl IX responded in 1607 by adding the title King of the Laplanders in the North to his official list of titles. Still, the noblemen on the Danish Council of the Realm remained unconvinced. They did not share their king's enthusiasm for war. But Christian didn't give up. In 1611, he tried again to get the council to approve an attack on Sweden. This, the king argued, was the perfect time. Sweden was weakened by decades of fighting in the east. Since the Northern Seven Years' War had ended in 5 episodes ago, the Swedes had fought against Russia, Poland, and each other basically non-stop. Sweden was weak, exhausted, ripe for the plucking. Also, John III had neglected to keep up the fleet, spending all his money on churches, so now the Danish fleet was the strongest and biggest in the Baltic Sea. Still, to the king's frustration, the council remained unwilling to commit to a war. And even though he was rich and powerful, the king of Denmark was constitutionally forbidden from starting a war without the consent of the council. But then someone had a bright idea. King Christian was forbidden from starting a war, that's true. But Christian wasn't just the king of Denmark, he was also the Duke of Schleswig-Holstein. And in his capacity as duke, he could start a war against whomever he liked, and the Council of the Realm couldn't do anything to stop him. So now Christian threatened the council that he'd go it alone. He didn't need their consent, and he didn't need their money either. As long as the war was brief, he'd be able to pay for it using his own money. He also made it crystal clear to the members of the council that after he'd won his brief, glorious war, he wouldn't share the spoils of the war with them. That prospect was too much for the council members. They agreed to declare war on Sweden, sharing the costs and the spoils with the king. The decision to declare war was made at a meeting of the Danish nobles in February 1611, and a declaration of war was issued on April 4th. In accordance with the laws and customs of the time, an official delegation, complete with an herald and a trumpeter, was sent to Sweden. This was standard practice. Until they had delivered the message to King Karl IX, the Danes were honor-bound not to initiate any hostilities. As I mentioned last time, King Karl wasn't prepared for a war against Denmark. He had focused almost all of his military efforts on the east, despite warnings from his advisors. Now, when the Danish delegation showed up with a declaration of war, the king made a last-ditch attempt at avoiding, or at least postponing, the conflict by simply refusing to see the herald. If he couldn't fulfill his mission, there could be no war. Obviously, that kind of tactic can only work for so long, and in the end, the Swedes had to accept receiving the declaration of war. But that wasn't the end of the shenanigans. Once they had received the declaration of war, they refused to let the Danes leave. Despite their diplomatic immunity, the Danish delegation was detained in Sweden for as long as possible, all in an attempt to gain time and better prepare for this untimely conflict. Meanwhile, in Denmark, King Christian was growing impatient. Eventually, he decided to attack without hearing back from his herald and trumpeter. The war that Christian had planned and argued for since his first years on the throne had finally begun. The war started with the Danish army crossing the border into Småland and marching on Kalmar. This was an obvious choice. Kalmar had always been of supreme strategic importance to Sweden. From a military perspective, whoever controlled Kalmar Castle controlled the Öland Strait, that is the waterway between the Swedish east coast and the long and narrow island of Öland. Kalmar was situated at the most narrow point of that strait, where it's only some 3 kilometers across to the island. If Christian could control Kalmar, he'd control the sailing route to Stockholm itself. Economically, Kalmar was also enormously important. A large share of Sweden's foreign trade was conducted via Kalmar, and losing the city would create all sorts of problems for supply lines and access to foreign markets. The Danish forces, consisting of some 6,000 soldiers under the personal command of King Christian, initiated the siege of Kalmar on May 3rd, and already on May 27th, the city was taken by storm. When the Swedish army, led by King Karl himself, arrived on June 11th, they found the city already in enemy hands. Not the best start to the war. But all wasn't lost. Kalmar Castle still held out, and without taking the castle, the Danes couldn't fully control Kalmar, and as long as the castle was in Swedish hands, the hope of recapturing the city remained alive. Karl IX was determined to retake Kalmar. The sooner the better. He arranged his troops for battle outside the city, but the Danes didn't bite. Christian didn't see any reason to risk anything by meeting the Swedes in the open field when he could just stay behind the city walls, eating, drinking, and pillaging everything that Kalmar had to offer. When the King of Sweden realized the Danes weren't willing to meet him in battle, he decided to try another tactic to lure the Danes out of Kalmar. He sent his son and heir across the border into Denmark to attack the city of Christianopel, hoping that the Danes would feel obligated to come to their countrymen's aid and therefore leave Kalmar. On June 26th, the Swedish army took Christianopel by storm. It was a relatively new city, and King Christian IV had named it after himself. He'd do this a lot during his almost 60 years on the throne. For instance, he renamed the Norwegian capital Oslo Christiania, a name the city would retain for the duration of Danish rule in Norway. Anyway, Christianopel was considered the first Renaissance city of Scandinavia, a model port town built in accordance with the latest fashion in urban planning. Christian IV had encouraged its rapid growth by giving it all kinds of privileges. He hoped that in time it would become a serious competitor to Kalmar, only some 50 kilometers further north. So, from a Swedish perspective, there was more than one benefit in destroying Christianopel. Early in the morning, the Swedes managed to force their way into the city by blowing up the gate, which was poorly defended. In general, it seems that the garrison left behind when the main army marched north towards Sweden wasn't expecting an attack. What followed was nothing short of a massacre. The day was spent killing, raping, and plundering, and in the end, Christianopel was burnt to the ground. Even the church was destroyed. But not even the brutal destruction of Christianopel managed to distract King Christian. He had his plan, and he was sticking to it. So the King of Sweden decided that he had no choice but to attack the Danes if he wanted to dislodge them from Kalmar. At about 1 o'clock at night, between the 16th and 17th of July, the Swedes started to move on the city. They hoped to surprise the Danes, but they were detected by sentries who sounded the alarm. When they understood that they had lost the element of surprise, the Swedes retreated. But soon thereafter, somewhere between 5 and 6 in the morning, Swedish troops sallied forth from the castle. they managed to fight their way to the southern city gate, and they captured it. Now the Swedes could enter Kalmar, which they did. They got as far as the city square before the Danes managed to organize the defense. Fierce and bloody street fighting followed, and at the same time the Swedish army, commanded by King Karl, resumed their attack. At this point, the city caught fire, but neither side felt inclined to stop the fighting to try and put it out. Against this dramatic backdrop of the burning city, Danish reinforcements arrived on July 18th. That meant that the Swedes were now outnumbered, even though the Swedish fleet still could offer support from the sea. That changed, however, when the Danish fleet showed up with 27 ships, and the Swedish fleet had to withdraw. In that situation, the Swedish troops on land were also forced to retreat, leaving Kalmar, or what was left of it, in Danish hands. Then, on July 23rd, Christian IV felt strong enough to bring his army out of Kalmar to face the Swedes. He arranged his troops in battle order in front of the Swedish camp, but now King Karl no longer wanted a fight. He estimated that his forces no longer stood a chance against the Danes, and instead he chose to retreat under the cover of darkness. The King of Sweden withdrew, knowing that all wasn't lost as long as Kalmar Castle was still in Swedish hands. And King Karl had every reason to believe the castle would hold out. After the city of Kalmar had fallen, the king had given the command of the castle to Field Marshal Christer Somme. He was an experienced commander who had led troops and governed castles in the Baltics, including Narva on the border to Russia. He was the best of the best. If anyone could hold the castle, it was Somme. Before the king retreated northward, his orders to Somme were clear. Hold the castle until we can return to back you up. Hold it at any price. Less than 2 weeks later, on August 3rd, Christer Somme capitulated and swung the castle doors open to the Danes. Somme would later defend the decision to capitulate, claiming that the castle could not be defended, that he didn't have the required supplies, most critically gunpowder. How are you supposed to hold a castle without gunpowder? Karl IX, though, wasn't convinced. He was outraged that Somme had given up the castle without a proper fight, and he accused the commander of treason. High treason. All Christer Somme's lands and property in Sweden were confiscated by the crown, and he was put on trial in his absence. In his absence, because as soon as he had left the Danes take over Kalmar Castle, Christer Somme chose to switch sides and enter into Danish service. King Christian gave him a castle in Holstein, where he settled into a comfortable life as a landed gentleman. Of course, none of this lessened the suspicion that he had committed treason. King Karl was furious at Somme, whom he had trusted, but he didn't limit his fury to the commander of Kalmar Castle. He was also really mad at King Christian. He sent his Danish counterpart a letter accusing Christian of unchristian behavior for breaking the peace agreement signed after the Northern 7 Years' War. He also challenged the Danish king to a duel, one-on-one, to settle their differences and to end the war without spilling any further blood. Christian IV only laughed when he received this letter and rejected Karl's challenge. And to be honest, that was probably for the best, considering that Christian was a young man at the prime of life, whereas Karl was already old and rather frail. So old and frail, in fact, that on October 20th that year, Karl IX died. He was succeeded by his son, who had commanded the troops that destroyed Christianopel. He now became King Gustav II Adolf, but since he's better known in the English-speaking world under the name Gustavus Adolphus, that's what I'll call him from now on. As soon as Gustavus Adolphus had taken over the throne, he reached out to Christian IV and sued for peace. But the King of Denmark smelled blood in the water. The old, but experienced, Karl IX had been replaced by a kid who didn't know what he was doing. Instead of accepting the peace initiative, Christian called for reinforcements, preparing to step up the war. And so, in January 1612, King Christian led a Danish army into Westrogothia, pillaging and burning as they went. Simultaneously, another Danish army crossed the border into Småland on a similar mission. So what did the new Swedish king do? Did he confront the Danish army in Westrogothia or Småland? Which of his people should be defended and which should he leave to fend for themselves in the face of the Danish war machine? That's an almost impossible choice, and Gustavus Adolphus chose neither option. Instead, he ignored both these Danish armies and led a Swedish army into Scania, pillaging and burning in Denmark instead. Among the victims of the Swedish raid were the people of the market town of Vær in northeastern Scania. The town was so utterly destroyed that the Danes didn't bother to rebuild it after the war. Instead, King Christian founded a new town in the area, a town he named after himself, because of course he did. From Vær, the Swedish army continued their campaign of destruction in northern Scania. In the evening of February 10th, Gustavus Adolphus and a small force reached the village of Vittre, where they decided to spend the night. Early the following morning, they were surprised by Danish soldiers who attacked the small Swedish unit. The king and his entourage had no other choice but to try and flee northward in the direction of the Swedish border, less than 10 kilometers to the north. The only problem was that they had to cross a river, and the bridge was held by Danish troops. The king was forced to try his luck by riding across the ice on the frozen river, but the ice wasn't thick enough. It broke, and the king and his horse went through and ended up in the freezing cold water. Gustavus Adolphus's reign could have ended then and there, but a couple of quick-thinking guys in his entourage fished the king out of the water and provided him with a new horse, because unlike the king, his horse didn't make it. So Gustavus Adolphus lived to fight another day, and the guys who saved him were later knighted for their services to the crown. Even though the king's return to Sweden was a source of joy to the Swedes, they didn't have much else to be happy about in 1612. In fact, soon news got back to Gustavus Adolphus that a Danish army was threatening Älvsborg Castle, that vital stronghold making sure that Sweden had direct access to the North Sea. Before the Swedes were able to do anything about it, Älvsborg fell to the Danes on May 24th, and the window to the west had been slammed shut yet again. The Danish troops had also occupied a large chunk of Swedish land surrounding the castle and destroyed the newly founded city of Gothenburg. The mood in the Swedish camp may have been gloomy, but King Christian of Denmark was ecstatic. So far, the war was going great. He had taken both Kalmar and Älvsborg, robbing Sweden of two of its most important ports on the east and the west coast respectively. Now he wanted to finish them off once and for all, so he ordered an attack on Stockholm itself, hoping that if that city fell, Sweden would collapse and his dream of re-establishing the Kalmar Union would become a reality. But just like so many other Danish invaders before him, King Christian would soon realize that Stockholm is a long way away from the Danish border. The desperate Swedes resorted to scorched earth tactic and burned everything in the path of the Danish army, stretching their supply lines to the breaking point. Swedish peasant soldiers also shadowed the Danes, sniping and attacking stragglers, foragers, and anyone else who didn't keep his guard up at every given moment. Since the mercenaries in the Danish army also hadn't been paid in a long time, many of them started to desert, considerably thinning the lines of Christian's army. That way, the grand assault on Stockholm dissolved into a fiasco long before the Danish forces could reach the city. Apart from that failed offensive, though, 1612 also saw a lot more pillaging and burning on both sides of the border. The Swedes desolated large swaths of Halland and Bohuslän, and the Danes were busy destroying as much of Dalsland on the border to Norway as they could. It says something about the scale and mode of the fighting that it's known as the Fire Feud in these parts of Scandinavia. Another noteworthy incident occurred in August that year, an incident that illustrated the depths of Sweden's problems. You see, by now the Swedish army was starting to suffer from a shortage of manpower. As you may remember, traditionally the Danish army had been smaller but made up of professional trained soldiers, whereas the Swedish army tended to be larger but mostly made up of peasants with only a rudimentary military training. Having a large peasant army that you could order to fight has its advantages, most importantly the fact that it's much cheaper than paying for professionals. But by now, after so many years of war, remember Sweden had been basically fighting wars non-stop since the last war with Denmark, the Swedish army needed a boost of professional mercenaries. This was bad news, since mercenaries cost money. Another problem was that the Danish fleet controlled the Baltic Sea, so even if Swedish recruiters managed to get mercenaries to sign up for duty, they'd struggle to ship them over to Sweden from the continent. The solution to the second of these problems was to look for mercenaries in other places. So the Swedish army had been recruiting mercenaries in Scotland. The plan was to then ship them to Norway and march them through that lightly defended part of King Christian's realm into Sweden. It had actually worked once before, and a unit of Scottish soldiers had sailed to the Trondheim area, where they had disembarked and marched through that gap in the mountains and joined the Swedish army. Now, in the summer of 1612, the Swedes hoped to repeat that maneuver. But this time, they wouldn't be able to land in Trondheim. After last time, the Danes had beefed up their defenses there. Instead, the two ships that left Scotland in early August set sail for Isfjorden, a fjord roughly midway between Bergen and Trondheim. From there, their march through enemy territory would be longer, but since no one expected them to land there, the Scottish troops would still have a decent chance at making it through Norway unmolested. On August 20th, the soldiers disembarked and started their march through the valleys of Romsdalen and then Gudbrandsdalen. Word about the incursion soon spread, but just like the Swedes had hoped, there were no Danish soldiers to send against the Scots. But there were plenty of Norwegian peasants. And to say that these peasants were hostile to Sweden and those who fought for her would be a bit of an understatement. Like so often was the case, this war had seen its fair share of atrocities, and now the peasants of Gudbrandsdalen united to exact their revenge. As the Scottish soldiers progressed southward through the beautiful late summer landscape of the valley, they were followed by Norwegian scouts. When the Scots reached Kringen, close to present-day Kvam, the sound of a horn cut through the crisp mountain air. If the horn confused the Scottish soldiers, they soon realized its significance. It was the signal to attack. The Norwegian peasants had chosen the spot for their ambush well. The valley was narrow and steep, with little room to move between the road and the river. The Scots were trapped, sitting ducks, basically. The peasants shot at them with muskets and crossbows, and according to some sources, they even pushed logs and rocks down the steep sides of the valley, trying to crush the invaders. Over half of the Scottish soldiers were killed in the battle. The survivors were rounded up and brought to a barn in the vicinity that was turned into a makeshift prison. The peasants received orders that the prisoners should be brought to Oslo, but most of the hapless Scots never made it. We don't know why, perhaps the desire for revenge was still too strong, or perhaps there were some other reasons, but instead of transporting the captured soldiers to Oslo, they were led out of the barn and massacred. Only 14 of the Scottish soldiers actually made it down to Oslo alive. A consequence of the battle, which is still remembered in the area and even reenacted and sung about by more than one Scandinavian heavy metal band, was that the Swedes gave up on trying to bring in foreign mercenaries via Norway. Clearly, it was trickier than it had looked on paper. Sweden still used mercenaries, primarily in the Baltics, but only where the Danes couldn't interfere with the recruitment and transportation. By now, Sweden was on the ropes. It seemed like Christian IV would be able to realize his dream and re-establish Danish domination throughout Scandinavia. It might very well have happened if Denmark and Sweden had been left to their own devices. But luckily for the Swedes, there were other players in the region, and they had their own agendas. Both the English and the Dutch were interested in the trade in the Baltic Sea ports, and they were worried that a total Danish victory in this war would impact their economy negatively. They already had to pay that hated toll to pass in and out of the Öresund Strait, and they feared that a Danish monopoly on Scandinavian trade would further increase the taxes, dues and fees in the Baltic Sea. So they decided that they had to put an end to the war before Denmark could crush Sweden. King James I of England and 4th of Scotland was on friendly terms with King Christian, and he managed to convince the Danish monarch to finish the war while he was ahead. It wasn't too difficult to convince Christian. The Danes were actually running out of money, and the offensive against Stockholm had proven to be a failure. Going for the total annihilation of the Swedish state at this point would require resources that King Christian just didn't have at the moment. And besides, he could be pleased with what he'd achieved in this war. The peace treaty was signed on January 20, 1613, by a bridge on the border between Sweden and Denmark, close to the village of Knered. It was a tough peace for the Swedes. It's true that they got Kalmar back, but they had to renounce all claims to the Arctic coast and accept that Lapland would be a part of Norway. Unlike Kalmar, the Danes held on to Elfsborg Castle, and once again the Swedes could only have it back if they paid for it. This, Elfsborg's second ransom, made the first ransom half a century earlier look like pocket money. To regain control over that all-important castle, the Swedes would have to pay an eye-watering $1 million within 6 years. There would be 4 payments, and if any one of the payments was late, the Danes would be allowed to keep not only Elfsborg Castle, but all the previous ransom payments as well. It's hardly surprising that the war-torn Sweden struggled to pay, and in the end even the Dowager Queen had to chip in by selling her personal silver to cover the cost. There was, however, a certain silver lining to this painful experience. It created a streamlined and efficient way for the Swedish bureaucracy to collect taxes, and this would come in handy in the future. Beyond having to give up on the Arctic coast and paying another ransom for Elfsborg Castle, the Swedes had to suffer one more humiliation. Gustavus Adolphus had to accept that the King of Denmark could keep the 3 crowns in his coat of arms, and they're actually still there to this very day. But all wasn't doom and gloom for the Swedes, though. They did manage to get one major concession approved. Swedish ships would not have to pay any toll when they passed through the Öresund Strait. But there's no doubt that Denmark was the winner in this war. Even though Christian IV had to shelve his plans to conquer all of Sweden, the Kalmar War, as it would be known, had confirmed Denmark's position as the dominant force in Scandinavia. The Danish army had proven to be a competent and strong force, and the Danish fleet had established beyond any doubt that it ruled the Baltic Sea. The outcome of the war had also convinced King Christian IV that he wasn't merely a real king, capable of winning glorious triumphs. Christian came away from the Kalmar War believing he was something of a military genius. Next time, that belief will be put on the test against a stronger adversary than the Swedes. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Scandinavian History Podcast. Even if you're shocked at the staggering sum Sweden had to fork up to get Elfsborg Castle back again. If you did, why not spread the word wherever you congregate with others who are also into Scandinavian history? Also, please consider leaving a stellar review, or at least 5 stars, on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. This is an excellent way to attract new listeners and to support the show. Another good way to support the show is to purchase some Scandinavian history-themed merch in the Scandinavian History Podcast webshop. I especially recommend something from the Odin's Lifehack collection. It's a line of merch with quotes from Havamal, accredited to the King of the Gods. You can get t-shirts, mugs, tote bags, and many other items with nuggets of Scandinavian wisdom, such as "Wake up early if you want another man's land or life," "Only fools hope to live forever by avoiding enemies," or "Speak useful words or be silent." Links to these amazing products and more can be found on the Scandinavian History Podcast Facebook page. If you haven't already, then please go to facebook.com/Scandinavian History Podcast. Like and follow the page if you want to shop, or if you just crave more content, at least vaguely related to Scandinavian history. Via the Facebook page, you can also send me questions or angry messages about things I've said or not said on the show. If you prefer the social media platform formerly known as Twitter, you can follow me and send me messages at Schenkman. That's S-H-A-I-N-K-M-A-N. I look forward to hearing from you.